You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Make Your Movie with Dave Bullis podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart.
Hey everyone, thanks again for joining me for another episode of the Dave Bullis Podcast. Joining me tonight is Alvaro Rodriguez. Alvaro is a screenwriter who is currently working on season 2 of From Dusk Till Dawn, the series. His career in film actually began when he began riffing on a Spanish guitar for the Heroes musical theme in his cousin Rob Rodriguez's debut film, Era Mariachi, which began a collaboration that has lasted over 2 decades. Alvaro, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Pretty good. The weather in PA has gotten a lot better over the past few days.
That's good. Same here in Austin.
Oh, nice. I actually want to talk to you about Austin, but before I get to that, so could you give us a little more detail about your background, how you got started in the film business?
Sure. I grew up with a love for movies, and I grew up with a love for reading and writing, and always wanted to be a novelist, and would, say, well, I know it's a hard road to try to do, and I'll probably end up being a teacher, which I was for a time, but I want to keep writing. But I had this cousin Robert who, when I first remember spending any time with him, we were kids at my grandmother's house in South Texas, sitting in the back of a truck, and he was talking about this new movie that had just come out, which he hadn't seen yet, but seemed to know everything about how the director had done this shot and how this was done and all this stuff. And my jaw was just on the floor of the bed of the truck because I realized I finally found someone who loved movies maybe more than I did. And that movie was called Escape from New York, John Carpenter's movie in the early 80s. And it was just like, a light had gone off in my head. I was probably in the 5th grade or so, and I started to write my first little scripts. I'd written a parody of the TV show Dallas and just thought, this is great. I'm going to write the scripts. Robert will direct them. And his sister Angela, his older sister, my older cousin, she'll star in them. She wanted to be an actress. And it actually did happen. I mean, she became an actress. She was in several movies and including a movie that I wrote with Robert called Shorts. So, it was amazing. It was amazing to see that all finally kind of come true. Later on, I did music for his first solo mariachi, like you mentioned. And right after that, we started collaborating on a script together, which never got made, called Till Death Do Us Part, which we wrote for an actress that Robert had met and thought was going to be the next big thing, and she was Salma Hayek. And ever since then, I just, was writing on different projects with him, contributing scenes or dialogue or ideas, including movies like Four Rooms and Road Racers and then later Planet Terror and then we wrote Shorts and Machete together.
So, you know, and then, you know, where did, you know, and actually, you know, I'll get to that later from Dusk Till Dawn, because I don't want to get, you know, too far ahead. But, I mean, that's absolutely amazing, you know, that, you know, you were able to collaborate with a family member, and it was so amazing he's able to open all these doors for you. And, you know, that, I mean, you know, and that's, you know, a couple of those things I want to touch on. So just really quickly, are you at the South by Southwest Festival right now?
I am indeed. Yeah, we're shooting my episode of Dusk Till Dawn, second season, second episode right now, and this happened to coincide with South by Southwest Festival, so been able to go and you know, do some screenings and you know, some networking and stuff like that. It's been fantastic.
So, are you filming this series in Austin then?
Yeah, the entire show shoots in and around Austin.
Oh,
so, Robert has his own studio, Troublemaker Studios, where he shot many of the films here in Austin, which is right next to Austin Studios, where we also have sets. And we're shooting in and around town, different locations. Machete was shot entirely here in Austin, too, on those sets and on those stages and in and around town. So it's amazing. It's amazing to be able to have that kind of those kind of facilities and just a great crew, great people that you know, that Robert uses again and again on all these different projects. So it makes our, you know, our little TV show look like a you know, big feature project.
I mean, that's amazing to be able to work with the same crew and everything over and over. You know, that is a great benefit. And also it's great that, you know, he has his own studio right there in Austin. You know, the reason I asked where you're shooting it was because, you know, with all these film tax credits and that, there's a, you know, the debate about, you know, do they work, do they not work? You know, I know sometimes you get thrown through a loop, you know, like season one of Banshee was filmed in North Carolina, and season two was actually filming here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Austin has really become, over the last couple of decades, you know, quite a film and television production hub. You know, this new series on ABC, American Crime, takes place in the best of California, but was shot entirely in Austin. Hopefully they'll be back for season two. You know, it's really amazing that Austin, you know, it just has developed a really strong reputation for film and television. A lot of people want to be here. You know, we have guys in our cast that have, you know, bought places here, and you know, and I've heard the same stories from other crew members on other projects that they worked on, and from other people that, you know, Austin is a place where, you know, actors want to come and they want to work here, and because they have such a good time in the city, and the city is very open to all those kinds of things. So it's a great creative nexus here in Austin.
Yeah, I've always heard that, and I've always heard that slogan, "Keep Austin Weird."
Yeah.
So you know,
we're doing our part. We're doing our part to keep it weird.
So, what's one of the coolest things that you have seen thus far at the South by Southwest Festival?
Well, last night I went to a screening that was touted as the 30th or so anniversary screening of The Road Warrior with George Miller, director, in attendance. And we got to see kind of a sneak after the film of the new Fury Road, the new Mad Max film. We got to see about 7 or 8 minutes of that, and then a special trailer that was just cut for South by Southwest. And Warner Brothers had struck a brand new print of the film. So it looked absolutely amazing. And of course, Road Warrior is such a huge influence on both Robert and myself. And Robert actually got to do an episode of his series on El Rey called The Director's Chair, where he, you know, interviews different directors. He just aired the latest one about a week or so ago with Francis Ford Coppola. So he got to film an episode with George Miller. And, you know, it's just amazing to see something like that in 35 millimeter. I think they said it was the only film at South by Southwest that was screening in 35 millimeter on the big screen in a beautiful theater downtown Austin, the Paramount, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. So it's just like, you know.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
And now back to the show.
It's a really amazing and kind of priceless experience to see something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I know you can't go into detail, but what did you think of the couple of minutes of the new Mad Max you were allowed to see?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really amazing. I mean, it was such a tease. It was like, please give us more. Please give us more. You know, because it just looks beautiful. And Tom Hardy, who plays Mad Max, looks fantastic. Charlize Theron, the entire cast. It looks like Road Warrior, you know, turned up to 11, and you know, Thunderdome, everything, and plus, I can't wait to see it. Opens May 15th, and it just looks absolutely amazing for, you know, fans of that kind of film. I can't imagine that anybody's really going to be disappointed. It looks stellar. I couldn't wait to see it after that taste of it last night.
And that's good to hear, coming from an actual fan of the original as well. With the trends you see now in film is, you know, there's a lot of remakes. There's a lot of, you know, old, you know, properties, established properties that are getting, you know, made, updated, like, you know, admit it, or even TV shows. But, you know, it's good that there are, you know, personally, like, 21 Jump Street, I thought that was absolutely hilarious. Like, you know what? I mean, I went in there with almost no expectations, and I came out and I said, wow, that was actually pretty damn good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing, you know, the remakes and reboots and reimaginings often get, you know, short shrift, and people say, you know, there's no more original idea. Well, you know, just because the Coen brothers made True Grit doesn't erase the first film, you know, doesn't erase the original. And a lot of things, you know, writing and entertainment and stories it's already inherently a system of recycling, you know. It's a system of taking something old and giving it a new spin in some way. And obviously you can fall on that as a crutch, but I think when you have talent and this will to sort of like make something better or make something with your own touch, and you have someone like George Miller, who, you know, at the helm of taking Mad Max and doing the reimagining or reboot or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, you're in the hands of a master, and there are so many, you know, it's a whole new generation who weren't able to experience The Road Warrior the first time it came out in the context in which it came out. You know, in the context in which it came out, it was like this, you know, this post-apocalyptic future that we seem to be so close to now. And that's one of the things that that makes, I think, the movie resonant, and doing the original again and giving it new ideas for what this reboot is going to be, you know? So I have, you know, I don't have the same sort of negative outlook on those kinds of things, I guess. You know, some people call things cliche, and I say, no, it's not a cliche, it's a universal truth. So just go with that.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with you, Alvaro. You know, sometimes what I seem to see from even my friends is there's two kinds of attitudes they have. Either they go like, they either say like, we see something like, you know, like a big budget blockbuster, whether, you know, it's a superhero movie or, you know, Transformers, right, what have you. They'll say like, you know, if they didn't like it, they'll say, oh, well, you know, what did you expect? They know, blah, 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 you know. Or the other one is, it's overrated, or, you know, it's this or that. I mean, it just seems to be like, if they, like when someone does try something new, there's sort of like, you know, you do see something new, it's almost like there's a trend, you know, in movie reviewers of like, oh my God, why were they doing this? And then, you know, that's where studios can say like, hey, we tried to do something new and nobody went to go see it.
Yeah, that's true. And there's this thing, you know, Dusk Till Dawn is a reimagining, as a television series, a reimagining of the movie and taking that world further, you know. So in so many ways, you know, we're guilty of it too, but we're trying to do something else with it, you know. We're trying to take it further and you know, develop characters, bring in new characters, but just utilize that world. And we have to, you know, the other thing to remember is exactly what you said. This is in so many ways a business. And sometimes it's easier. It's a different it's an easier sell to sell someone something that they think they already know. But it's the same, but it's different. And it's that kind of ability to take something that people already are familiar with and give it back to them in a new way. And I think that when you do that well, people respond to it well. And that was one of the great things about working on the show, is that, you know, it was apparent very early on that everybody involved, the cast and the writers and the directors that were brought on board to direct episodes, they were all coming to this as a bit of a passion project. Nobody was really there, in my opinion, just kind of picking up the check and you know, walking away from it. Everybody was really invested in the project. And I think you get a sense of that when you watch the stuff. And so, you know, I think that's the best you can hope for, the best you can ask for.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've watched the whole first season, and you know, I can definitely tell, you know, you have both of the Gecko brothers. They both, you know, one looks like Clooney, one looks like Tarantino. I thought, I mean, that was excellent casting, by the way. I was like, wow. I mean, I could see, you know, the finding someone that looks like Tarantino, he has a unique look. So I was like, man, that one must have been either the easiest casting session ever or the hardest casting session ever, because, you know, I mean, either you have to look through a ton of headshots or, like, you know, only two got, you know, two or even closely resemble, you know, actors who were submitted. And, you know, and when I watched when I watched it, you know, especially the first couple episodes, it takes place, you know, in that same little convenience store with the sheriff, right. and you know, and you know, it was, you know, very well done. And and then there's also for those who haven't seen it, there's also a whole layer that you've added to the TV show as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in that opening episode, which is really based on the first 5 or 10 minutes of the film, you know, in the film, the character of the Texas Ranger Earl McGraw is played by Michael Parks, mm-hmm. and he gets killed off in that first 10 minutes of the film. And we had, you know, Don Johnson playing the character on our show. You know, he's a tremendous actor in it to begin with, but we were going to extend his role so that even though his character died in the first episode, he was in flashbacks for the next few episodes, and so you got to see more of that character. And that's a lot of the fun of a project like this too, is that it exists in this special, you know, world called the Tarantino universe, you know, the mm-hmm. Tarantino verse. You know, Earl McGraw shows up in Planet Terror. Earl McGraw shows up in other Tarantino things. So you've got this kind of continuity of story and things like that. These characters that kind of show up in these different Tarantino kind of related things. And so it's amazing to have a small part in that world.
Yeah, and I think you've done a phenomenal job. When I first heard about, you know, the Dusk Till Dawn series, you know, I was like, you know, was this going to be a continuation? You know, is this going to be a prequel? And then I watched it. I was like, oh wow, it's really interesting what they've done here. And they sort of,
well, you know. I was just going to say, back in the day, you know, back in the late '90s, I actually had Robert was out in Japan promoting a film he did called Faculty. And we were messaging each other online, and he said, you know, Dimension and Miramax were interested in doing a couple of sequels to Dusk Till Dawn. Probably it would be straight to video and shot back to back, and asked me if I had any ideas. And so I pitched an idea for basically a sort of spaghetti western prequel to Dusk Till Dawn, which we ended up making as Dusk Till Dawn 3, The Hangman's Daughter. With Michael Parks playing a real life character named Ambrose Bierce, who disappeared in Mexico around the time of the Mexican Revolution. And so it was great to have already kind of had the background of doing research. The story also is sort of the genesis of Santanico Pandemonium, the character played by Salma Hayek in the original film. And kind of came up with this different backstory for her, and researching all the sort of Mesoamerican mythologies of, you know, Aztec and Mayan things, and our own special ideas about what these creatures were that inhabit this bordello south of the border. And So coming to the show again, it was like taking some of those same ideas, but going so much further with them and creating, you know, more backstory and more sort of lines of story and plot and character arcs and all that kind of stuff.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That really was fun to work with and coming up with ideas for the season, especially since, you know, after the first season, the movie is over. We kind of took that movie and turned it into 10 episodes of television, obviously with a lot of new material, a lot of new characters added. The character that Wilmer Valderrama plays is one of three characters that Cheech Marin plays in the film, Carlos. And in the movie, you know, he's not that much of a character. And in our show, Carlos has become a main, a huge part of the show, a big anchor for the show. And now in season two, the world is open again. And so being able to create the season arc that takes us completely out of the movie now, but following these characters and allowing the stories and storylines and arcs to grow from characters instead of, you know, just following what we had already seen. Well, you know, it was a great challenge and also just a great opportunity to try to do something interesting and new.
So Alvaro, when you're, you know, working together, I imagine, you know, before each season, you know, you and all the other writers are in the room together. You know, how much outlining do you do before you actually all get started writing your own episodes?
Well, it was really kind of an amazing process. We had kind of an 8-week stretch last summer to just talk out where we were going. And one of the, I think, really invaluable things that we did was we brought in each of the main characters, each of the main actors, you know, one at a time to come into the room and talk about their character. You know, tell me what you thought about season one. How do you feel your character, you know, feels at the end of season one? How does your character feel about other characters on the show? Well, what did you like about season one? What did you not like about season one? What would you do differently? What kinds of things, you know, would you like to see your character doing and stuff like that? And that really kind of gave us a lot of ideas. And we started out with some ideas about where we thought we would go in the season, but you know, it was a really evolutionary process and a really collaborative process, I think, that was amazing. And then as far as outlining, yeah, there's so much of, you know, like they say, so much of writing is rewriting. So much of writing is also the pre-writing process before the scripts of, you know, writing outlines, having them, you know, brought to the table, having them torn apart and rebuilt. You know, ideas that you know we had for, you know, a big finale that might get just pushed, you know, further or closer to, you know, before the end of the season, so we can even go further from the big idea that we had and all those kinds of things. You know, it really is sort of and nothing is written in stone sort of thing as we're in that process, and things are very fluid and flexible with the idea of being open to trying to collaboratively and individually, you know, bring your A game and keep constantly trying to challenge ourselves to make things better. Well, one of the things our showrunner has kind of instilled in all of us is this idea of, our showrunner is a guy named Carlos Toto, who's worked on several shows and has great record in television. And one of the things, you know, he would say is if someone brought an idea that everybody thought, hey, that's a really good idea of characters, you know, we could do that, let's see if we can earn it. You know, let's just not try to put a pin over here and say by this time this has to happen, but let's really see if we can get our characters to that point organically through the characters themselves getting to that good idea. You know, so it's a real challenge, but you know, it feels like, you know, we're all working together to try to do that.
And you know, it's really great to have a showrunner, you know, with a lot of experience, you know, to actually sort of guide it along. I mean, you know, I've actually talked to other writers or other shows, and they've mentioned how important that person can be because, you know, like you just said, you know, people have to earn it, and you can't sort of just force it just because, hey, it's a cool idea.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, I think that spirit really continues on, even as we're shooting an episode, you know, to come up with an idea, even as we're shooting and say, you know, maybe this needs to happen. Well, it's, you know, let's not try to force it. Let's really try to find a way to make it seem like a natural, organic part of the story. And so, you know, we're just really, really fortunate and, you know, to have created these constellations of great, great crew, great actors, you know, great directors of photography and great directors on our episodes to really kind of try to, you know, to do the best that we can with our ideas and with the scripts and, you know, try to put out something that people will be intrigued by and want to keep watching.
So, you know, Alvaro, now that you have, you know, the episode and everything from the writers' meeting, you know, how do you personally sit down to write? I mean, I know you probably have a couple of points and a couple of things that you have to incorporate in the episode, but do you sort of break it out into the eight parts, like, you know, the eight structure theory, or do you just do the traditional three act, or do you not do any of that and just go full forward in?
Oh, well, you know, we definitely stick to a structure. You know, on our show, we kind of go with what we, you know, present as a five-act structure, you know, and the outline, you know, will reflect the act breaks. And, you know, so like I said, sometimes there's a fluid and those change. We'll always try to have a really good, strong, you know, act out and then a strong act in, you know, in between the breaks and stuff like that. So, you know, the outline process is fairly rigorous and is really as detailed as we can possibly make it. And then other things are left us, you know, with our show, and I call it, you know, writer's opportunity to, you know, kind of, you know, when you're writing the script, actually find something that, you know, will not have been in the outline or not as clear in the outline that suddenly in the writing of the script itself, you know, nothing. But as far as the writing process, you know, it's a lot of crying, a lot of procrastination, a lot of, you know, suicidal thoughts, and then somehow putting together something that you know is going to be challenged again, you know. And I think that in a lot of ways that's a liberating part of the thing too, you know, is realizing that you know, it's our duty to try to give the best that we can, but realize that, you know, it's always going to be improved upon. It's really always going to, it's still a malleable thing up to the moment that you shoot it, because there are things that happen, there are new ideas that come in. One of the great things about this particular season is that we were able to have, you know, all of our scripts written before we actually started shooting. And so that allowed, you know, for a certain amount of, you know, being able to go over the entirety of the season, of the scripts, and really try to, you know, make sure all the setups were set up and all the payoffs were paid off, you know, and everything got hit. So, I mean, it sets the bar pretty high. So hopefully we can make that jump.
So, you know, has your writing style sort of changed over the years, you know, from, you know, obviously I was looking at your IMDb and your first actual writing credit is, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn 3, Hangman's Daughter. So when you wrote that to where you are now, has your writing sort of a process changed a lot?
I think the process has probably changed a bit. And I think that the style has probably changed a bit. I mean, I remember back at that time, you know, one of the executives who was at Dimension at the time said, you know, your script is great. It reads almost like a novel. And I realized that I was, you know, I really wasn't trained as a screenwriter. A lot of this was, you know, kind of learning by doing. I never had taken any kind of screenwriting classes or anything like that. I didn't go to school for screenwriting. I was an English major, but I had a lot of background in both. I had three semesters of creative writing as an undergraduate in poetry, of all things, and then I was also an entertainment journalist for the student newspaper. I was an assistant entertainment editor, and, you know, and I had done some news stuff too. I was working in a newspaper when I was writing Dusk Till Dawn 3, and it felt like, you know, those things which I sort of discounted were actually strong primers for screenwriting, because in screenwriting, it's so much about the essence of things and you know, such a skeletal structure.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That the poetry lent itself to that, because in poetry, so many times you're trying to create, you know, sensations and images and emotions in a reader in as few words as possible, creating these images in as few words as possible. And in journalism, you know, it's kind of this just the facts, ma'am, kind of reporting, you know, which also lends itself to screenwriting. So those were actually powerful, you know, sort of setup tools for me. But you know, even then, I feel like I learned to kind of find my voice. I think my voice was there in the first script, in Hangman's Daughter. It wasn't the first script I'd written, but it's the first script that, you know, got made. And then to kind of hone that down and keep trying to to convey as much information as possible in the most economic way possible, and try to really find the power of the language in order to, you know, to convey in the reader's mind, you know, that might be, you know, a reader who's picking up the script and is the one who's going to pass it on to the next guy or not, or to, you know, actually have a shooting script and have, you know, the director read this and say, you know, this is how we're going to do this, or the director of photography read this and say, this is how it's going to be shot, without using, you know, without telling them exactly what they're going to do, but just to be able to sort of suss that out for themselves in the script that you've written. So yeah, I think it's definitely evolved, I guess, if I can use that word again, as part of the process. And that, you know, I hope that I can keep, you know, keep evolving and keep getting better at what I'm doing.
And you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's amazing that, you know, you're always, you know, finding new ways to improve. You know, I've noticed that too. You know, you touched on something about, you know, you said the script read like a novel. You know, as I do more screenwriting as well, and even read scripts, I've finally realized now that actually reading screenplays that have either been produced or not produced, but have been like either bought or optioned, really gives you a view into that world that, you know, any screenwriting guru or whatever can't give you, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing too. I mean, I spent a long time once I started really writing, and, you know, Hangman's Daughter, and after that, of amassing a library of anything I thought was useful. But among those, you know, practically every book on screenwriting ever written, I was always trying to find, you know, I was always trying to find shortcuts, maybe is not the right word, but sort of techniques or ideas of things that could help me, you know, in the process. And the problem with that sometimes, and it was for me, was that, you know, it can become a crutch, because it can actually become kind of a stifling effect. And when I was writing, and I would be like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I know the answer is probably on this shelf over here somewhere, or these shelves, or this whole, you know, this room of books. And I think that the more that you actually do in the process, the more that you're actually involved in the writing process, the less that you feel like you need those kinds of things, because you've already sort of you've made them a part of yourself. They're inherent in your own sensibilities, because, you know, you've been a reader your whole life. You've read scripts, or you've read novels, you've seen movies, you understand the language of film, you understand the language of screenwriting, and I think, you know, it's sort of getting to that point where, you know, I always kind of use the example of when I was an undergraduate, when I first got to the University of Texas, I tested out of 16 hours of Spanish, you know, and I never had to take Spanish at the college level. And I felt like I never really got as intensive a training in Spanish as I could have. And it wasn't until years and years later that I was finally like reading books in Spanish and realizing I wasn't translating into English in my head as I was reading. I was just understanding it. And I think it's the same thing with the writing. It's like I already had the language of screenwriting and the language of cinema in my brain. And I just needed to kind of tap into it and realize that all of these things, or many of them, were already inherently a part of my my own sensibility, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, I've realized it too, is that when you, you know, sort of, when you start doing it, and, you know, doing it is the most important part, when you start getting in there and actually writing and, you know, beating resistance and you know, you start to realize you don't need those signposts as much, you know what I mean? So, you know, I mean, you, I'm sure you've heard of, like, you know, the certain rules, like, oh, by page 17, this has to happen.
By, sure.
And, you know, and you realize that, you know, those guideposts aren't, like, definitive rules. They're just, you know, right. Either, I guess you could say principles, or, you know, someone was just like, hey, look, I noticed that on page 17 of these scripts, this happened. So therefore, here's the rule.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I did take workshops later on, especially, like, I did the Save the Cat workshop here in Austin with Blake Snyder when he was still alive, and it was the first screenwriting workshop I'd ever done, and it was so amazing to me because what Blake had done in his book and in the workshop was to take, you know, this sort of 15 beats and how show you how it, you know, if you could look at Jaws and you could look at, you know, a comedy and you could look at a horror film, you could look at whatever genre it was, you could always sort of find these sort of 15 things in it. And the way that he described them was, you know, it's like the Casual Fridays version of, you know, Story or Lou Hunter or whatever, that that it was so accessible, you know. And but I think the thing about those things too is that you really kind of have to take them as a descriptive and not prescriptive, you know. It's describing a thing that already exists. And when you know, you can definitely apply them and it will help you in structure, but don't be so confined to a page number or anything like that. Just know that this is sort of the way stories have been told throughout time. And that's why I feel like so much of it is inherent. It's kind of telling you stuff that you already know, but putting it in the language that makes it sort of accessible and easy to understand, you know? So I think all those things are valuable. I don't discount them in any way, shape, or form. But I think that you realize that it's kind of telling you things that you sort of already intrinsically know, and maybe have just not thought of in those terms before. Gives you a terminology. Gives you a way to name the parts, you know, of the body of your story, and realize, hey, you know, the knee bone's connected to the shin bone, and that's the way that the body works. That's the way story works. And if you put these pieces together and realize that there's a framework, then you can kind of, you know, mess around with that and twitch things around and surprise yourself even, and with the hopes that that's going to surprise the reader and that's going to surprise your audience. And I think the other thing is to not discount at all the value of actually working with actors and actually being involved in the process, so that, you know, I mean, for me, I was always kind of describe myself as a guy chained to the laptop in the dungeon, and these were all just the voices in my head I was writing out. But when you actually, you know, on set, where actors like Don Johnson or Robert De Niro in Machete, you know, is doing lines that you wrote and bringing his own sensibilities to them and stuff like that, it's like it opens up, you know, it's like if we were on the chakra level, it's just like, you know, your mind explodes, you reach the crown and you reach nirvana when, you know, someone like Robert De Niro is doing your dialogue and bringing this whole other sensibility to it that you didn't see even as you were writing it, that can influence the way that you approach writing, approach writing dialogue, or approach writing scene, or whatever it happens to be. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a very good point. You know, sometimes I'll sit in with script readings because, you know, I co-founded a writers group 2 years ago, and we still meet. You know, we meet twice a month, and, you know, yeah, when everyone's done, we actually stage readings. We actually get actors and have a reading in a conference room all together. And it's, you know, the writers who wrote that particular script, you know, they're always frantically taking notes because you're actually hearing now, you know, a different voice added to that, you know, and because, again, like you said, they come to, you know, putting their inflection on the character.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And just, you know, even things that you thought work on the page that don't work, you know, in the reality of the situation, or that's another thing too. It's like just an example of last season of working on an episode that I'd written with Robert Patrick, and we were rehearsing the scene, sitting around the table with Robert Patrick and Madison Davenport, Brandon Sue, who would play Kate, and Scott Fuller, his children, on the show.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And there was a moment I was just kind of glanced over at Robert, and he just had this look on his face. And I just told him, I said, you know, I can't even look at you because you're so intense right now. I mean, you can do more with one look than if I gave you a page of dialogue. And realized that the physicality of the actor is something that you never could sort of underestimate in the writing process, and realize that you have to leave something for the actor, leave something for the actor to do. Recently in Los Angeles, I went to some screenings of films that John Borman made, starring Lee Marvin, you know, particularly Point Blank, and a movie called Hell in the Pacific. And Duane Epstein, I think his name is, had written a biography of Lee Marvin, you know, told a story about a scene in Point Blank in which Lee Marvin's character comes back to see his wife, who basically set him up or watched as he was allegedly killed and left for dead. And he comes back just to see her and realizing or thinking that he's going to kill the guy who tried to kill him, that he's been now shacked up with his wife. And I had this scene where Lee Marvin had all this dialogue with his wife, and he just asked if he could not say any of it and just have the conversation be on from the wife's side. And so it's just his wife kind of talking to him as if they're having a conversation, but it's only her lines. And he's just giving her a look. He's just looking. And he's just acting without dialogue. And you see how smart that is, first of all, and how brave it is for an actor to say, I can do this without words. You know, I can do this with my own physicality, with my own presence, without having to just say everything that I feel. I can show you that. And to think about that as a writer is, it's an amazing sort of lesson in realizing that this really is a skeleton, and it's the actors and it's the director's photography and it's the directors and it's the lighting crew and everybody else that puts the flesh on those bones. It's something I think about, in the process of writing, trying to kind of leave that space. You know, that's what the white space is, I think, on the page. The white space is the place where the actor shines. The white space is where it's not, the sort of snappiness of the dialogue or how well you wrote those action lines. It's the actors themselves, the characters that are breathing in between those scenes, in between those lines. I talk about a Jonathan Richman song about the Velvet Underground. He has a line in where he says, they played less notes and left more space. And that's sort of the thing I tried to do in screenwriting, kind of play less notes and leave more space. Leave that space there for the actors to inhabit. And I think when you really have a strong scene, like the scene, I think, is my favorite scene in that episode, where these characters are sitting together realizing that they're kind of stuck in this place, and Seth Gecko is kind of forcing them to confront their own demons in this little scene, that the ballad is good, that it's really what the actors bring to it. It's really so much of what they're showcasing their own talents and their own capabilities. That it provides a lesson to me as a writer.
Yeah, it's sort of, adding that layer of subtext, and it's sort of, finding a way to actually say things without actually coming out and saying them, and all the things below the surface. And, I've never actually seen that movie, but I will make sure to actually check that out, because that's a phenomenal way to tell a story.
Yeah, point. I mean, I think he also gave another example, another movie that Lee Marvin did with director Richard Brooks called The Professional, which is a Western. It's also, I'm sure it's a big influence on Quentin Tarantino and things like that, too. But Point Blank and The Professionals and Hell in the Pacific, which is basically, in a lot of ways, a silent film in which Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune, the Japanese actor, are stranded on an island in World War II. And, you know, one of them speaks English, one of them speaks Japanese. It was remade in a way as Enemy Mine in the 80s by Wolfgang Peterson, with Dennis Quaid and Luke Gossett, as a sci-fi movie where, you know, a human and an alien are crash-landed on this planet. And, you know, you just... they're just such strong lessons for writers, I think, to look at structure, to look at how a story is told, and to look at the, you know, to sort of be reminded of how much can be done with silence, or how much can be done with the with telling a story. Well, Robert told the story, I'm not sure if it's actually in the director's chair or not, but something that Francis Coppola had told him when he was doing the interview about, you know, something that you like to do with the actors is shooting an entire scene without dialogue, just as a rehearsal, as a practice, you know. And Robert said he never actually done that before, but he was really intrigued to try it, you know. And I think that those, you know, there's something that can be gained by that. There's definitely a lesson to be learned from the writing standpoint and from the directing standpoint too, you know, because you're not dependent on what's coming out of the actor's mouth as much as you are, you know, remembering that this is cinema, you know, this is a visual medium. People remember shots, people remember quotes from movies all the time, but, you know, when you have a scene and you let the actors sort of really inhabit that scene and you're not in a hurry to yell cut, you know, you can find some impressive moments and hopefully, you know, remember them in a way that that will illuminate your own writing. At least I do.
And you know, that is a very interesting technique as well. You know, one of these, you know, film books I have, I know you can't see it right now, but there's a whole shelf of screenwriting books behind me, of films and everything else. One technique.
I'm sure I have one.
Yeah, I'm sure we probably have almost the entire same library.
Yeah.
But you know, there was a technique where the guy actually says, "Watch your favorite film without sound," and just see how every scene plays out.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one piece of advice that I've often given people who, you know, either in a workshop that I've taught or led, or you know, people who ask me about, you know, writing something. And I said, well, you know, like, you've seen lots of movies. So what's your, you know, think of a movie that has a great scene in it that you really love. And then try to find the screenplay for that movie. And read the scene. Read what does that look like on paper? You know, if you have this favorite scene from, you know, I don't know, The Exorcist or To Live and Die in L.A. or I'm particularly freaking examples. But, you know, what does that look like on paper? You know, if it's an action scene, what are the action lines read like? You know, what does that look like? And just to see the thing that you've always seen completely visually, and what does that look like when it's words on paper? You know, and you know, to see how that was translated to become the scene that you loved in the movie. I think that's a really strong lesson to kind of just to experience that in a different way. And match them up.
Yeah, and I agree. That's something I've done too, is actually go out and find the screenplays of things. Speaking of which, you know, the Oscars weren't, you know, too long ago. As soon as I watched Birdman and The Grand Budapest Hotel, I was like, I got to see these screenplays.
Right.
I think right. You know, those two and Whiplash are definitely the best written movies in the Oscar race. And those are three screenplays. I was like, I just want to see how they did this. And you know, it's phenomenal. And actually I had one of the writers of Birdman, Alex Denilaris, on here, you know, about
awesome.
15 episodes ago. And he was, you know, it's just awesome to be able to pick his brain. But, as it is yours, because, you know, you're the guy who actually wrote, you know, all, you know, these films that, you know, we're talking about. So you can actually tell us, no, this is what I did, you know? And, so, you know, speaking of which, you know, I want to ask you, you know, about Machete, and you know,
sure.
I wanted to ask you, you know, did you come up with this, you know, the inception of this idea, or was it Robert, or was, you know, was it of your brainstorming?
It was always Robert and Danny. I mean, I think you know, when Robert first met Danny Trejo, when he came to audition for Desperado, the story goes where Robert took one look at Danny and said, you're the guy. Danny was auditioning for a character called Navajas, which means knives, and he's a knife thrower in Desperado with Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek. And, you know, Danny had been acting for many years already, usually playing, you know, thug number three or, you know, the bad guy, Fall Apart. And, you know, Robert just, like he said, became fast friends with Danny and said, you know, it would be great to make a movie in which you're the hero.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, you're the guy. And I think that was sort of the inception of Machete. And Robert had written kind of a long treatment, scriptment kind of thing for a Machete character. And then when it came time to make Grindhouse, you know, which Robert made Planet Terror, Quentin Tarantino made Death Proof, and it was released as a double feature, and it came up with this idea of really kind of going with the whole double feature drive-in concept and doing fake trailers for movies that didn't exist. And so Machete became one of those things. And it was like, well, great, we can just make the fake trailer. We never have to make the movie. But then, you know, even though Grindhouse, you know, sort of underperformed at the box office, the trailer for Machete sort of took on a life of its own on YouTube and things like that. And people really responded to it. So it became a thing where, you know, we thought, well, we're actually going to do it. And I, you know, I started writing around the time of Grindhouse. I was there and wrote a little bit of dialogue that is actually in the trailer with Cheech as the priest. And then, you know, later on just started, you know, working from the trailer, basically, and creating a new story, you know, a fuller story out of it, and having, you know, creating more characters, the Jessica Alba character, the, you know, the Michelle Rodriguez character, the Don Johnson character, all those kinds of things that just really evolved over time until, you know, we actually made the film. And you see, you know, you see how it turned out.
Yeah, and I thought it was phenomenal. And you know, it was that Grindhouse theme. You have the cuts, the scratches, and you know, and it's just, you know, and Danny is the perfect guy to play a guy. I mean, he looks like a guy named Machete.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I just did a panel with him at a Comic-Con in Fort Lauderdale a few weeks ago. You know, and someone from the audience asked, you know, what's your favorite character? And he said, you know, Machete and Marshall Brady.
Yeah,
so I had to ask him how that happened. And he said, yeah, you know, my manager said, you know, I think we got a Super Bowl commercial. And he was like, you're kidding. You know, what do I have to do? He said, well, it has to be Marshall Brady. He's like, I'll do it. So, you know, even that is just like, so amazing. It was so amazing to see. It's terrific. I'm glad to should be a small part of you know the sort of persona that Danny has, you know, has been able to inhabit as that character.
So when you know when they were filming Machete, were you on set every day, or were you not, or just a few days, or?
Yeah, I was on a few days. I was on off and on. It was, you know, it was amazing. It was amazing. I got to, you know, be on set when Robert De Niro was there, and you know, got to talk to him a bit. And you know, he was so generous and so kind. And I think the thing about, you know, the thing about him too was that, you know, he had expressed interest in becoming involved in the project early on to play this senator. And in the original draft of the script, the senator was just the guy that gets shot. He was not really a character in the script. So we really started having to try to build a character out of this guy. And so, you know, but the thing that, you know, we understood from Robert De Niro was that he wasn't interested in, you know, doing it unless there was really something there to do. And he didn't want people to feel he was just, you know, picking up a check. And so, you know, started coming up with ideas and setting in dialogue and concepts and stuff like that. And we get responses like, yeah, that's good, keep coming. And, you know, finally hit on sort of the finale of his character in you know, the speeches that I'd written for his character, you know, when he signed on. And one of the funny things is, you know, in the finale of the film, after he's been shot and he's dying on the floor, on the ground, you know, with Lindsay Lohan dressed as a nun hovering over him with a gun, he's sort of kind of blanking out. He starts, in my script, at least one draft of it, he starts reciting the act of contrition, the Catholic act of contrition, in Latin, like he's reverting back to his actual, you know, he's not really a Texan and all this stuff. And Robert read that thing, and he's like, what the hell is this? And he's like, you know, he's not really a Texan. He's reverting back to his, you know, New York childhood or whatever. And he's an altar boy, and he's reciting the act of contrition, get forgiveness before he dies. And he's like, that doesn't make, you know, he's never going to do that. And then they were on set one day, and I got a call from Elizabeth Amiyan, who was producer on the film. She's like, Oliver, we need the Latin. I was like, what are you talking about? It's like the Latin thing that De Niro says. He's working with a priest. He wants to get it right. I was like, holy cow. But that was the thing. And he was so, he came to set completely prepared. He knew every line of dialogue. And he did, you know, it was never a thing where, you know, I don't know my line or whatever like that. Please, you know, he was totally into it. And I think he had a really good time doing it. He certainly had, it was definitely a highlight of my professional career as a writer to say, well, you know, I did a movie with Robert De Niro and Lindsay Lohan and Danny Trejo and everybody else. But, you know, he was definitely an actor who I'd grown up, you know, just loving every film that he had done. And was so impressed with him and his presence. But I had stories like that for a lot of the actors that I've worked with. They've just been really fortunate to have people that just always seem to bring their A-game, you know, our little movies.
And that has to be such a high as a writer, too, to say, you know, hey, Alvaro, who's your, you know, movie? Oh, we had, you know, Robert De Niro. And
right.
So,
absolutely.
And you know, you also, you know, you touched on, you had Lindsay Lohan, and also you had Steven Seagal in the movie as well.
Steven Seagal, who was great. We had, you know, Don Johnson, you know, written some things. You know, Robert had spent a lot of time with Don Johnson before, and so, you know, we used some of the like little phrases that Don Johnson said in the script. And I was sitting with him one day on set, and he was like, oh, I love this. This is great. You know, it's like, I say stuff like this. Like, how did that blow your skirt up? And I said, I know. That's why we put it in the script. We wanted it to be very natural for you. It was, you know, just amazing. Really amazing. Even during the editing process, I was sitting with my cousin Rebecca, who Robert's younger sister, who had done was working on the film as well. We were watching the De Niro scene, and I said, "Can you just stop it for a minute?" And she said, "What? What's the matter?" I said, "I just need to take a minute. You know, that's Robert De Niro, and he's saying lines I wrote, you know, in my room, and now it's just, you know, it's just like I just need a minute." But, you know, it's great. And whenever stuff like that happens, it's just like, it's important to just say thank you and be amazed by it all.
And you know, and that is absolutely amazing. And you know, like you said, it's also, as I've been finding it, too, to have gratitude as well and always miss and live in the moment and not, you know, just sort of when you see Robert De Niro and just want to stop it there. That's, you know, that's amazing, Alvaro.
I was just, yeah. I'm still getting goosebumps right now just thinking about it, you know. And it was a great experience. And, you know, the movie did well. You know, I was just really proud of, you know, the way it turned out and realized that, you know, the last draft is the final edit of the movie, you know. There's so much of that movie that so many ways that movie was improved by the edit and really making it come together. You know, it's far from a perfect movie, but it's definitely something I'm proud of. And you know, it was a great experience to be involved with it.
And you know, I particularly like the final battle between Seagal and Trejo. Because if you asked me, in a million years, I never would have guessed that, you know, those two ever would have crossed paths, and you know, in any movie, because they sort of do different movies, you know.
Yeah.
But they were able to come together for Machete, and it's just, you know, I mean, I thought it was very well done too. And Seagal was still doing his Aikido, and you know, Trejo's still swinging the machetes. He's still kind of a street baller style. I thought it was very well choreographed as well. I thought it was phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, you know, that's, again, it's just like, you know, it, part of that, part of the whole process of Machete too is realizing fairly early on that this is going to be in so many ways the kind of kitchen sink.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Screenwriting. It's like nothing is off bounds. Nothing is, you know, out of bounds. Everything is, anything is possible. You know, you could have a scene where a guy rappels down a building with, you know, someone's intestines. Or, you know, Machete stabs those cops, you know, or the fake cop through the back of his feet in the back seat of the car, and then steers the car by turning his machete through the guy, you know, and stuff like that. And it's, and you know, so it was pretty liberating in that way too, and realizing that you're going to have this crazy final showdown where, you know, there was anything was possible, and you could have, you know, sword fight with Machete and, you know, and Seagal and his sword, and just, you know, it was just turning everything up to 11, I hope.
So, you know, when you were actually writing it, did you actually know Seagal was going to be cast in that part, or did you actually, you know, evolve that part later on when Seagal was cast?
A little bit of both. I mean, the character was starting to be there before it was Seagal, and then knowing it was Seagal, things were, you know, were enhanced and added to it. It was really, I mean, that was part of the process with the movie itself. I mean, even from Lindsay Lohan's character too. I mean, Robert, you know, told me, if I can get Lindsay Lohan to play this part, I said, it's not even a part. You know, we got to try to, you know, give her some stuff and just sort of, you know, hit on these different role ideas that this kind of, you know, gave her her own arc and told a little story, you know. So it was great. It was so much fun to be a part of that process.
And you know, that's great that everything was able to come together. You know, very, you know, it's something, and you know, you've been involved in movie making for, you know, two decades now, and you know, whatever can go wrong will go wrong on a film set. And, you know, or even beyond that, you know, even when things are in development, it's so good you were, you know, able to put it together. But I mean, again, if you have any listener out there who has not seen Machete, I urge you to go out there and check it out. It's phenomenal.
Thanks.
Alvaro, you know, we've been talking for about an hour now. Would you mind just taking a few quick questions that got sent in?
Sure.
Okay.
Flew by.
I'm sorry?
That was an hour. It flew by.
Yeah, it always seems to work out that way. Which I don't know if I just asked the right question or, you know, I just sort of, I don't know. So, but you know, I'm glad it flew by. Because I mean,
well,
it's
a conversation.
Yeah,
it's a conversation, you know. And when you talk and you're having your conversation, you're not looking at your watch. So that's the way it goes. That's good.
So our first question is, Alvaro, would you ever consider directing your own film?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely am interested in doing that. Years and years and years ago, I had written. It was actually my first screenplay, and I was, you know, hoping to direct it. It was going to be very low budget, very independent, Texas-based project. It never really got off the ground, but sort of as a training for that, I went and made a short film on video that, you know, no one has ever seen, no one will ever see. But, you know, it was, and it happened so quickly, it was not much of a lesson to me except to realize that I needed a lot more experience to do it, you know. And then for a long time, I just, you know, whenever I was asked that question, I would say, you know, I just, right now, I'm just really trying to focus on being a better writer. And that's still my answer. I'm still trying to focus on being a better writer, but I'm definitely interested in doing that other role behind the camera. And you know, I think that's part of the great opportunity of working on Dusk Till Dawn is that it's, as a writer of the episode, you're sort of writer-producer, you're there on set, you're working with the actors as much as you want to be. And so I've had, you know, pretty hands-on experience in terms of, you know, working with the actors, rehearsing with the actors, you know, even helping block scenes, and things like that, that, you know, that to me, it's like, again, sort of more fuel for the fire, really wanting to take the opportunity, to try to, you know, to direct as well. I mean, I guess it's a thing too of that lesson, that I feel like I've learned or am learning about, you know, these sort of things that are sort of, that I have the language or cinema, in some way already in my brain, and that I can, you know, I can approach these things, in that way, you know, with a very open heart and mind thing. You know, I'm always going to try to be learning. And I'm the director in training, or writer in training, or whatever, you know. But learning by doing and trying to be as involved in the process as possible.
I mean, and that's awesome that you're actually thinking about, you know, writing or directing your own film.
I hope so.
Yeah, because honestly, because then you could, you know, be like, you know, your cousin or Tarantino was, you know, write and direct and, you know, really put your stamp on the film, kind of like, you know, the auteur theory of filmmaking. But this time, you know, you can say that because, you know, you're the writer director, you know, and you know, that's all you.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the auteur theory is a wonderful concept, and I certainly think that it holds true, you know, in a lot of ways. Directors, especially value directors, you know, they definitely have this stance. But I think that the thing that maybe I realized coming at it from the perspective of the writer, and just sort of being the fly on the wall sometimes in on set or whatever, in any kind of environment, when you see the process, that, you know, filmmaking and television is the most collaborative, creative form that there is, in my mind. It is completely a collaboration. Nothing is possible without, you know, everybody's input and everybody's efforts to make this thing happen. You know, if you really want to be an auteur, you know, write poetry. There's no one that's ever going to say, you know, I'd really love to write a poem with you, you know? and I think that's, I mean, to me, that's, I think that's in a lot of ways why, you know, Robert has really depended on and created relationships with people with whom he can work again and again, actors and people behind the camera, because there's a sort of shorthand language that becomes developed, you know, and there's a sort of unwritten expectations of what people are bringing to the table. And it doesn't mean that he doesn't direct. He obviously does. But he's able to get what he wants by virtue of having a really strong cast and crew. And I think he would be the first person to acknowledge that. It may not have been that way in the early days because he was so hands on. He was so, you know, with El Mariachi and the short films that he made before then. You know, it was always a thing of he was really trying to become a master of all trades, not just a jack of all trades, but a master of all of them, because he never knew what was going to be the thing that was going to get him a job. You know, maybe people will hate my movie, but they'll love the way it was shot, and I'll get a job as a DP. Or maybe they'll hate, you know, they'll hate the way it looks, but they love the script, they love the dialogue, and I'll get hired as a writer. And so he was always, you know, really trying to find the best in himself to fill all those roles to see which one, you know, was going to be the one thing that people responded to. And they happened to respond to all of it, you know, in so many ways. But, you know, now on the big scale, it's really impossible to do that so much anymore. And I think that, you know, whenever you see these speeches, when people accept awards and they thank, you know, the writers, or they thank the producers, and they, you know, they thank the people who put this thing together. And it is so much of a community experience. And I think Orson Welles said every movie is a miracle. And the miracle is that you get all these different people who may have all kinds of different opinions to work together to put a common cause. And that's really, I think, what a strong director does. It sort of unites the team. and get everybody, you know, working for the good of the project and doing their best.
Yeah, and just to add on, you know, you said, you know, the director is the guy that sort of leads a team and builds a team. That's so true. And one thing that I've always heard is the idea of genius around, which means, you know, always hire people that are smarter than you are.
Oh yeah.
And you know that, yeah. And that way, and they said, you know, being part of the director's job, it can be, you know, taken care of.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Just by hiring a good, you know, having a great script, having a great cinematographer, and then having great actors, and then you pretty much, you know, it's only yours to mess up from there.
Right. I mean, if I were to go direct a film right now, I would have no idea, you know, well, what kind of lighting am I going to use? Or what's the right terminology for this piece of lighting or that piece of lighting? Or this lens or that lens? I would have no idea at all. I might have, a very, very, very basic idea. But, I mean, that's the thing. It would be a matter of really kind of surrounding yourself with people who know what their tasks are. That's they know their strengths. So you're trying to put together a team. Well, not everybody has the same strengths, but because you put together a team, now you're a pretty badass team. And it's just your job to make sure that it all kind of comes together in the way that you want it. And you keep pushing until you get what you want.
Yeah, yeah, very well said. And our next question is, Alvaro, what advice could you give for someone trying to break into Hollywood?
I always felt guilty about that question because, I didn't, in a lot of ways, I haven't broken into Hollywood. And what I have done is, been able to work with Robert on many, many projects. I'm working with other people on other projects and getting other things off the ground, features and stuff like that. But, obviously I feel like I had a huge door open up for me that I scrambled through as quickly as I possibly could. At the same time, you mentioned the 20 years of filmmaking experience. But a lot of those years, I wasn't making film. A lot of those years, I was not as involved as I could have been. I never really kind of took the bull by the horns and said, I'm going to go to LA and I'm going to try to, to work my way into the system. And everything has a time and place. But I would say that, to kind of follow up with your genius surrounds idea is to try, is there so much in this, in my experience at least, I don't know if I can speak to the business, but I'll definitely say in my experience that you cannot undervalue the power of relationships. And every time that I have had any kind of success, any kind of forward movement, it's always been built upon relationships and meeting, putting yourself in a space where you can meet people and find common interests and things that you can do. I mean, one of the huge things for me was when Machete came out in 2010, I was invited to be a panelist at the Austin Film Festival. And I really, literally was the guy chained to the laptop in the basement for such a long time, even though I'd been already done Festival Bond 3 and 8 years earlier. I was suddenly, up on stage, doing panels with real working professional screenwriters that I had somehow conned into thinking I was one of them. And, it really opened a lot of doors for me because I became instant friends with a lot of people I'm still friends with today that have helped me in so many ways. In the times that, that I would go to California and try to set up, meetings, from the point the plane landed, going to have coffee with one guy, says, "Oh, you need to go talk to this guy. Oh, you should meet this person." And then coffee and breakfast and lunch and drinks and dinners and, after things and just like really networking, putting your best foot forward, and being a bridge builder and trying to, to find those things, find the ways that will help you get where you want to be, you know? And I found that, you know, having boots on the ground in California and Los Angeles, especially, has been over the last couple of years, especially, has been huge for me. It's almost like uncanny, just the sort of chain of things that, you know, someone I didn't know, you know, last week, 2 weeks later was saying, you know, I would like to, you know, work on a project with you, or would you like to be involved in this, or would you give me some ideas about this, and then something happened, you know? It's pretty amazing. But I think that's the thing, is you've got to put yourself in the position to create that kind of environment, you know? So, if it means starting small, and it means starting in a local writer's group, then do that. And find the people in the writer's group that you really compliment. With an E, not an I, but you know that are, you know, that bring something to the table that you don't. Maybe you can work with them, or maybe they're going to work with you, and just start, you know, really start building your relationship as you're building your own talent, and building your own skills, and then, you know, it's just push. And I think that's the thing. It's push as much as you can. I don't know what else to say about it. And I just wish, you know, I wish everybody good luck. And, you know, we're living in an age right now where the demand for content, I don't think, has ever been as high as it is right now. The opportunities have never been as plentiful as they are right now. I mean, in a lot of ways. And I think that just sort of the willingness to say, I'm ready for work. I'm ready for you know, I'm ready to take this to the next step, and join yourself in the mix is as good advice as I think I can give.
And, you know, again, you know, just from networking meetings and, you know, just finding out what you can do for people and being a bridge builder. And, you know, again, I think that's key. Not sort of so much asking what other people can do for you, what you can do for other people.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, people don't want to, you know, be sold to constantly. It's like, you know, like when I talk to people about social media to Alvaro, I always tell people, you know, don't constantly promote yourself. You know, don't constantly talk about this, you know, because that's just a turnoff. No one's going to follow you just to hear all about you constantly.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, I think that's the thing that, you know, social media is still in its infancy in a lot of ways. And that is a lesson that people are quickly learning. I'm learning it too. And, you know, I think that there's this... The thing about social media is to really kind of, I think, if you try to use it in your best interests, it's not always to be self-promoting, but to be sharing, you know, to share other people's successes, you know, and promoting other people's projects and stuff like that. So when someone, you know, a friend of mine posts, oh, you know, my friends are trying, you know, I have a Kickstarter, you're really trying to get this project off the ground, you know, if I have $20, I'll throw it into the... Also, I've never met these other guys. They're friends of my friends. You know, I'll throw in the money and I'll promote it on my Facebook page or whatever. But, you know, if I can do that, I want to share, you know, whenever I do social media stuff, whether it's like Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram or whatever, you know, there, you know, you can be a navel gazer and you can just be all about me. And I definitely do some of that and say, oh, look, you know, here I am in the writing room and I'm, you know, in some semi-exotic location in Los Angeles or whatever. Or I'm saying, you know, you need to be watching this show, American Crime. It's the greatest show on television right now, and people are really going to dig it. Because I have friends that are active on the show, friends with guys who made the show, and it's just like, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'd like to do, and just try to kind of spread the goodwill. Yeah. And you know, you just, like, there's so many people that, and so many connections that you can make. I mean, I've never met you in person. I only know you from Twitter and things like that. And, you know, I wouldn't be doing this podcast with you, if, you know, otherwise, you know. So I'm, and you know, it's an amazing tool, and it can build relationships. It can connect people together in ways that they, you know, would have been impossible 10 years ago. So I think that's great.
Yeah, and I find a lot of guests through Twitter too, because that's how I think we initially met. And then, yeah. And then now, yeah, you're right. It's, you know, and using Twitter as a networking tool has been awesome for me. Just meeting people and just seeing what they're working on and stuff like that. I've actually tinkered around about actually writing a book about how I use Twitter as a networking tool.
Actually, great idea.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh, thank
you. I'll definitely tweet about it.
Well, thank you. It's on my pile, Alvaro, of like, you know, the 8 million things I want to write. It's like, okay, that's a good idea. Maybe I should do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. You know, I might get around to someday. Right now, you know, I'm just focusing on some other actual writing things.
Yeah.
But you know, we've been talking for about, you know, an hour and 18 minutes or so. So, you know,
okay.
And I know, you know, you're busy and you know, I don't want to keep you too much longer. So, you know, in closing, is there anything that we didn't discuss that, you know, you wanted to mention or talk about?
I think we covered it. I would just say that, you know, like I said, I feel like, I'm not the last person to give advice, but you know, because I still feel like I'm trying to be learning every day. I'm trying to keep that perspective on everything. But I know that there's things that I picked up that if I can impart to someone else, and they can get something out of it, you know, I think that's great. I mean, it's like, you know, use what you can use, and, you know, what you can't use, just throw it away, you know? And I think that's the same thing with so many of the things that are out there for aspiring writers or, you know, writers that are trying to break into the business, you know, just because you've read it in a book, or it's, you know, you've got to make the experience valuable for yourself. You know, I did teach for a short while. I taught a course at Texas A&M in Galveston, a study skills course of all things. And I had the students read this bit from a Herman Melville novel that nobody reads anymore called Redburn, about a boy's first journey to sea. And he's taking he's going to Liverpool. And he's taking his father's guidebook to Liverpool. And when he gets to the city and he opens up the guidebook, he realizes the city has changed. And that, you know, his father's guidebook really wasn't that much helpful to him anymore. And he had to sort of find his own way in the city. There were some things that were the same. And there was some sort of landmark, but the city had changed. And I think that, you know, the lesson I was trying to impart at that time, it's like, you know, I'm giving you a lot of ideas about how to kind of manage your time, how to study, how to work in groups, how to do all these things. You know, you might find that most of it is useless to you. You got to find what works and not be afraid of trying new things and of being open to experiences and really trying to build on your base and never sit back on it and say, you know, I know it all and people will just have to recognize my genius, you know. It's a constant learning process, and I'm still doing it. So I wish everybody that's listening and trying to do those things the best of luck in doing them.
Yeah, very cool, and you know, that's a very very awesome positive message, Alvaro.
Thanks. Very, it's all about the positive.
And that's good. It's good to be about the positive, because you know, there's far too many negative people in this world. So Alvaro, I want to say thank you very much again for coming on.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you know, my pleasure's all mine. So you know, where can people find you at online?
I'm on Twitter at Al Rods, ALRODZ. I'm on Facebook, I think it's the same thing, at Al Rods. You'll find me around. I don't have a site or anything like that. But I'm often doing, you know, different events. I'm not really doing anything at South By, but every year I'm pretty active with the Austin Film Festival doing panels and roundtables, and you know, every October you can definitely find me around there. But look me up and keep an eye out on LRA Network for Dusk Till Dawn Season 2 later this year. So hopefully we've got some good stuff in store for fans of the show. And, the first season is already on Netflix in its entirety. Or if you're really into it, you can get the Blu-ray or DVD set with all the extras and the commentaries and fun stuff like that.
And, I'll make sure to link to everything in the show notes as well. So, everyone, if you don't ever have been to El Rey Network, or you've never actually seen Alvarez Twitter, just click on the links in the show notes and you'll be taken right there. And I'm also going to link to Dusk Till Dawn Season 1. So again, if you haven't checked that out yet, please do, because it's very cool, especially if you have enjoyed the movie it's based off of. And again, yeah. Alvaro and I have said, it just expands upon that. So in closing, everyone, thanks again for listening. You can find me at DaveBullis.com and Twitter. It's at DaveBullis, at Dave_Bullis. And, there's tons of show note links that if you want to, stalk me on any other social media sites, they're there as well. And, cool. So cool. Alvaro, thank you again, buddy. And, I wish you the best of luck with, season 2 of Dusk Till Dawn. And, if you ever want to come back, man, please let me know. The door is always wide open.
Thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you too, bud.
All right. Take care.
Have a good night, buddy.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.